Multifamily Matters, a weekly radio show that discusses the current topics and trends in the multifamily industry. Stay tuned and listen to the movers and shakers in multifamily share their opinions and thoughts about what's old, what's new, and where the multifamily industry is heading in the future. You are listening to Multifamily Matters, because multifamily matters.
Well, welcome and thank you for tuning in to Multifamily Matters, the only broadcast radio show in the nation that's solely dedicated to the multifamily industry. I'm your host, Paul Marks. We have a great show with two special guests who are extremely knowledgeable and right in the middle of today's topic. Today, we're discussing something that is very important and timely to the multifamily industry, and our topic is the real effects on multifamily assets of COVID and the eviction moratorium. I have joining me by phone two longtime multifamily industry veterans, Bob Nichols, the owner and CEO of Monarch Investments and Management Group, and Andy Newell, the CFO of Monarch Investments and Management Group. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Good morning.
So to kind of give our listeners a real understanding of your backgrounds and of Monarch, so that they'll know we're talking about real world statistics and real world examples of what's happening. Monarch is a multifamily owner that has assets located in 21 states across the country. The NMHC, National Multifamily Housing Council, in their annual survey has a report of largest apartment owners. In 2019, Monarch was ranked 20th in the country with over 49,000 units. In 2020, you were ranked 13th in the country with over 56,000 units. And you're waiting right now, I think next month, 2021's report will be out. And you're anticipating moving up in the rankings because your inventory has grown to over 64,000 units. So obviously, the topics we're going to be talking about today, you're operating properties in these states and operating that number of units. So you have some real-world experience in these topics that we're talking about. This isn't just guessing. This is actual boots-on-the-ground experience in what we're talking about. So, Bob, I want to start with you. The first question would be, what are the real stats that are out there, and what are the dynamics of the eviction moratorium? What have you seen across the country?
Well, Andy came up with a report that he can allude to, but you know, about a year ago, the CARES Act was enacted, and it was in effect until late July. And we could not conduct business at all in regards to evictions. We weren't even allowed to post delinquent notices on the doors of our residents. That was illegal as per the CARES Act. So a lot of our residents, you know, didn't pay who could have paid. And, you know, that was extremely upsetting to have the government get into contract and property law. And there's been a lot of lawsuits that are winding their way through the courts, one of which is in Texas, challenging the current CDC order. But we negotiated and navigated our way through that period of time pretty well. Since we always put our budgets together in December of the prior year, and we ended 2020 ahead of budgeted gross income and net income, because our mindset was to work with our residents. We always do when they're in trouble, and we always have an assistance letter that says, hey, file unemployment. Usually it's just state unemployment. You know, talk to friends and family, go to religious organizations. We keep a list of employers hiring in the area, and, of course, the CARES Act added on top of all that the federal unemployment assistance originally at $600 a week. And and the stimulus checks, of course. And so what we saw during the course of the year was that evictions, and Andy can talk about this more in detail, in our footprint were down about 60% from 2019. So that's not too surprising because we weren't allowed to evict at all for a period of time, at least for financial reasons. And then there was a bit of a lull end of July to I think it was September 5th when the Trump administration put together the CDC order. But the good news about the CDC order is that we could conduct business normally, where we could post, we could talk to our residents, we could file evictions. There was the forms that residents would sign to say, hey, I'd be destitute if I'd be evicted, and therefore judges would say, well, you can't evict this particular person, or we wouldn't even go into court. So, you know, at least we could vet out many of the folks who, you know, quite frankly, were scamming the system and not paying at all. Now, that's the federal piece. There's statewide eviction moratoriums of different ilks. And so, as you mentioned, we're in the middle of the country. So Minnesota and Illinois, as an example, have had and still have statewide eviction moratoriums. And mostly they're for hardship, too. Now, the folks in coastal markets, the multifamily owners on coastal markets have it way, way worse than us, where it's similar to the original CARES Act. They can't even notice their residents and certainly can't evict them. So it's been more than a tale of two cities. It's probably been a tale of four or five cities, depending upon what state you're operating in and if you're just dealing with the CDC order, or on top of that, the statewide eviction moratoriums as well.
Excuse me. So, Andy, let's take a deeper dive into it. We've got about 4 minutes left in this segment. Tell us a little bit more about what you found in your report.
Sure. The challenge we had is there is no centralized federal database for eviction information. And so it really was a matter of going into whether it's municipal courts or district courts, we really had to dig through the data, and we were able to get what we felt was really good data from 12 of the states that covered 25% of the population. And when we looked at that, that's the number Bob referred to, was evictions were down 60%. And even when the moratorium was lifted briefly, we didn't see an increase, and all the way through December, they're still running at less than 50% of historic norms. I think one of the challenges is that the term eviction evokes somebody being kicked out into the street immediately, and that's really not the scenario at all. You know, an eviction is just where we notice the courts that, you know, we need to potentially repossess our rental property. And in the vast majority of times, 54% of the time in our case, the resident got the notice, realized this was serious, and just went ahead and paid and stayed. And about 23% of the time, the residents, you know, they were working through their own financial situation, and they voluntarily left, realizing that they needed to find more affordable housing. And only 12% of the time did the tenants rely on the CDC declaration to avoid the eviction. So, you know, after all was said and done, only 11% of the time was there a physical eviction. And that was true during the last year, and that number isn't too far off the mark from what we have historically seen, that around 11% of the time, 11 to 15% of the time, is there an actual physical eviction. So, you know, again, I think it sounded good for the federal government to make people feel better about this eviction moratorium, but it really just disrupted the business. It was not a forgiveness of rent, so I think there was a lot of confusion from people. They didn't realize that the debt was just going to stack up and that wasn't going to go away. So, you know, when you get to the actual numbers and you look at the actual numbers, I think that I think it's clear that it probably wasn't necessary, and it probably put a lot of people in this situation that they're going to have a very hard time digging out of.
Yeah, and some of the information you shared with me from March through December of 2019, actual evictions from 12 different states were 742,380. And then from the same time period, March to December of 2020, the actual evictions from those same 12 states was $310,675. And as Bob said, that's not surprising due to the fact that, you know, the moratorium was in place. Anything else that we should read into those numbers? We got about 30 seconds left.
Well, the only...
Go ahead, Bob.
Go ahead, Andy.
One of the things that I think people also need to be aware of is that evictions aren't always for non-payment of rent. I mean, there are drug dealers out there. There are violent criminals out there. There are people with dangerous animals. There are people that consistently don't follow community rules. And in those situations, you know, an owner not only, you know, an owner actually has a responsibility to evict. I mean, they have a responsibility to the other tenants to evict. So I think one of the things that, you know, might also be lost in here isn't that, you know, this isn't necessarily landlords that are trying to evict for non-payment of rent. These are sometimes people that we have a responsibility to evict.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Well, we're going to break it here. We're going to be back after this this short break. You're listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.
COVID-19 has greatly impacted the multifamily industry, emphasizing the need to reduce costs and increase revenue right now. PM Workforce can help you by providing intensely trained, performance-ready, certified leasing professionals. On-demand labor gives you more control over staffing costs. Their proprietary technology allows you to solve staffing problems within 60 minutes, 24/7, 365. Go to PMWorkforce.com before making a long-term hiring decision. Try one of their leasing professionals today. PM Workforce, the leasing company, consistently excellent.
Your multifamily property's water and sewer rates are skyrocketing every year. The only way to lessen the impact is to reduce water consumption through water conservation. EconServe has pioneered a no-cost, no-risk water conservation program, and it doesn't cost you a penny. A property in Houston is saving over $196,000 a year with this no-cost program. Call EconServe today at 713-662-3220. For a free analysis of your property, that's EconServe at 713-662-3220.
In a world where keeping up with an ever-evolving technology landscape continues to be a challenge, Allegion helps property managers cut through the noise to supply their residents with the amenity most critical to the digital generation, mobile access control. Ideal for the multifamily market, Allegion has designed mobile-enabled solutions that streamlines access while providing the security and benefits for developers, property managers, and residents alike. To learn more about Allegion's access control product offerings, please visit usallegion.com/MFM.
Well, we are back, and you are listening to Multifamily Matters, and today we're discussing something that's very interesting and timely. Our topic is the real effects on multifamily assets of COVID and the eviction moratorium. I'm Paul Marks, and joining me today by phone are two longtime multifamily industry veterans, Bob Nichols, the owner and CEO of Monarch Investments and Management Group, and Andy Newell, the CFO of Monarch Investments and Management Group. Before we jump back into the conversation, I do want to let our listeners know if you would like to provide show topics, guest ideas, suggestions, or just listen to any archived episode of Multifamily Matters, please go to our website at multifamilyradio.com. So Bob, we talked a lot about the eviction moratorium in our first segment, and you know, we're promising our listeners we're going to touch on COVID. Full disclosure to our listeners, we are doing this show in March of 2021, so vaccines have come out. You know, hopefully the tide has turned on COVID, but It's been a tough year. It's been pretty much a year since COVID-19 was listed as a global pandemic by the World Health Organization. Tell us a little bit about how COVID affected the way you operated your properties. You've got a large footprint in 21 states, 64,000 plus units. Obviously, it creates operational challenges. What did you find out?
Well, our annual meeting is always the first full week in March on the Wednesday and Thursday. And last year, March 4th, were the first two confirmed cases of COVID in the state of Colorado up at the Vail. And so as we were concluding our meeting, I went up skiing at the Monarch ski area that we own. And over the weekend, I just said, wow, we're going to have to change everything that we do with all the protocols in the office. And so all the distancing, the protective equipment, the number of people that we could let in to offices at one time. So that next week, myself and the corporate staff, we pretty much work 7 in the morning until 10 at night, trying to figure out all the different protocols that we needed to change to keep both our office staff and field staff safe and residents as well. And so we were looking everywhere and anywhere to try to understand as much about COVID as we possibly could, look to see what other industries were doing to keep their staff safe. We fought as well to be considered essential workers so that our staff could go in and be in the office to continue conducting business, and our maintenance people could get out and perform work orders, projects, and, of course, unit turns. And so so we did that. And the net result of all that was, we have 2,000 employees. I think about 300 of us, including myself, have contracted COVID. 3 were hospitalized, not in ICU. Everybody's recovered, and we've had no deaths. But I'll tell you, for a couple of months there, it was trying times to try to rewrite everything to say, okay, what do we do to be safe in the office? And then for maintenance, we hustled and got as many work orders we could done before states started shutting down. Then we got the gowns and shields and masks and other protective equipment for our maintenance men, as we were saying, well, gee, what happens if there's a COVID positive unit and there's an extreme work order in that unit that we, like a big leak or something, and we've got to send our guys in there. We got to make sure that they're protected and that can go in quickly, get the work done, and then get out safely. So it was challenging, but we did it, and the results are good. Our occupancy pre-COVID was 95.5. It's up over 97% now. Our gross income's up. So from a business perspective, when you look at financial statements, you'd never know that we're in a worldwide pandemic. But to get there was challenging.
Yeah, it sounds like it took a lot of work. And Andy, I want to ask you this question. One of the things in past episodes we've had during the whole pandemic, the common denominator that people have mentioned is how key communication was with your on-site teams throughout the throughout the portfolios, because of the fact that things were changing on a regular basis. You would get one protocol and procedure in place, and then all of a sudden another one would have to take its place. And a lot of the on-site teams, without that good communication, found it to be somewhat frustrating. How did you guys fare in that?
Yeah, we have we started daily phone calls with all the regional managers. The regional managers are the boots on the ground. They're the ones that are going to be most effective at talking to site staff and communicating the information. So we started daily calls with regional managers just to talk about the constantly evolving situation, to make sure that we were getting feedback on, what was going on in their market, because not all markets were having the same challenges. So we needed to make sure we both shared the information we were aware of from a federal level and collect information regarding the challenges that they were having, so we could continue to change the way we provided guidance out to the field. So we started with that, now that scaled back to 3 calls a week, and then it went to weekly calls, but we're still doing those calls, and they're still critical for us to, both communicate in both directions. One of the other challenges we had is, as these changing landscape occurred, we also had to make changes internally to make sure our systems were working correctly. The late fees were no longer allowed, so we had to get in there and reprogram our computer systems. We were trying to enhance our online payment abilities, you know, for residents to pay us online, because, you know, obviously we wanted limited interaction with site staff. And then we were really trying to put residents on payment plans that would work for them. So we had quite a bit of back office work going on trying to get that all configured and figured out. So, you know, it was really across the board, all the way from site staff to our accountants to some of our data and analytics folks that had to figure out how to, you know, be aware of what was going on so they could figure out what their role was in the process to make sure that they were able to do what they needed to do to make sure we were running correctly.
Well, and we've got about 3.5 minutes left in this segment, but I wanted to ask you a question, because in all the interviews that we've done and guests we've had on the show during this pandemic, you know, we've talked a lot about communication, the same types of things that you mentioned that a lot of people are trying to do. But one thing no one has ever mentioned to me, and I noticed it in some of the show notes that you provided, is the results that you had. You were able to do some special things for your teams. Tell us a little bit about that.
Andy, you want to take that?
Yeah, in terms of
You had some additional bonuses that you were able to work out for your teams.
Yeah, absolutely. We wanted to make sure the site staff, you know, back in the corporate office, we were able to rotate people through and operate at, you know, 35% and ramp that back up to 100% over time. But, you know, with site staff, we didn't really have a choice. As Bob mentioned, if there was a work order that needed to be done, an emergency work order, they had to be there to take care of it. And our office staff were there for the residents to talk them through everything, you know, and work with them on payment plans. So we set aside some money, and we were able to bonus out about $1 million to the site staff just to make sure they understood, you know, how much we appreciated their efforts.
Yeah. Bob, talk a little bit about that and why you think that's important.
Well, I mean, these people were on the front lines, and you had other industries who were also providing those kind of bonuses. And I wanted to recognize people who, you know, they're out there working in a different environment than what they had signed up for, and exposing themselves to a disease that we just didn't know how it exactly operated at that time, and or how deadly. It turned out to be not as deadly as what was originally forecast by experts, but very transmissible. And so so we wanted to recognize those folks. The other thing we did is we always give staff part of the promote, sweat equity, if you will, on new purchases, and we expanded that out as much as we could and carved in a bigger piece of that pie, so the pie got bigger and the piece of the pie got bigger to the folks on the site levels. And so we still bought 8,000 units last year, and that number became very large. And today, staff owns over $85 million worth of interest in the 64,000 unit that we own.
That's fantastic. And as I said, I mean, I've spoken with a lot of people, and no one's ever talked about those types of numbers before dedicating it. You know, obviously people, they appreciate it. They give some types of bonuses. But, I mean, that's a significant thing, and you guys are to be commended for thinking about your teams that way. We're going to go ahead and break it here for this segment of this episode of Multifamily Matters, and we're going to come back after these messages. You're listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.
Do you have multiple multifamily properties in your portfolio? Take control of your unpredictable IT spending with our managed IT services. Whether you have 5 or 500 properties, CTS has you covered with 24/7 nationwide remote and on-site support. Our pricing allows you to budget IT costs year after year with a predictable flat monthly rate. CTS provides the expertise, management, support, and tech infrastructure for all your properties. Call 888-255-9715 or visit ctsglobaltech.com for a free quote.
In a world where keeping up with an ever-evolving technology landscape continues to be a challenge, Allegion helps property managers cut through the noise to supply their residents with the amenity most critical to the digital generation, mobile access control. Ideal for the multifamily market, Allegion has designed mobile-enabled solutions that streamlines access while providing the security and benefits for developers, property managers, and residents alike. To learn more about Allegion's access control product offerings, please visit usallegion.com/MFM.
We are back and you are listening to Multifamily Matters, and we're discussing something that is very important and timely to the multifamily industry. Our topic today is the real effects on multifamily assets of COVID and the eviction moratorium. I'm Paul Marks, and joining me by phone are two longtime multifamily industry veterans, Bob Nichols, the owner and CEO of Monarch Investments and Management Group, and Andy Newell, the CFO of Monarch Investments and Management Group. I do want to take a moment and thank our exclusive sponsors that make Multifamily Matters possible, EconServe, providing multifamily water conservation solutions for properties across the U.S., PM Workforce, the leasing management company, consistently excellent, Allegion, a leading provider of mobile-enabled products and solutions for efficient access control within multifamily properties, and CTS, complete technology solutions, making managed IT an easy business decision for multifamily. So, Bob, I want to talk a little bit about a comment you made in the last segment where you had said even with COVID and the time frame of COVID last year, Monarch purchased over 8,000 apartment units, which is kind of surprising, I would think, in most people's eyes based on everybody kind of pausing there. But you guys were aggressive, and that's great. Tell us a little bit about what you found when you were going out to the market to look at that as far as pricing and so forth.
Sure. So when COVID hit, we didn't know. COVID hit and a lot of businesses started to shut down, and we didn't know what percentage of our residents were going to pay us rent. And the CARES Act came along and provided a lot of assistance. But we analyzed our resident base in mid-March of last year and tried to figure out, okay, what businesses were really going to be hurt. We weren't in any of the sort of travel industry areas like Orlando or Vegas that really got hammered. But we analyzed each resident group and came up with an idea that we'll probably collect 95% of our gross income. Well, it was 99.6 in April and then over 100% of our budgeted gross for the rest of the year. So during that time, too, we had six transactions on the books. Some were multi-property transactions, and we went ahead with four. We felt real good about the areas and the properties. We put two aside for a month because we're able to contractually, and we ended up picking those up in May and closing on those as well. By May 10th or so, as collections were normal compared to the previous 10 years. And by the way, Andy's group came up with a daily collection report, and we ran it three times a day. We never did that before, but we wanted to, in our database, Yardi, you can go back and compare to each month or each February or each March of the previous 10 years. And so we could look at the pattern of collections on what we got in by the 5th of the month, 10th of the month, or any particular day of the month. And by May 10th, we were collecting normally. And, of course, a lot of businesses were shut down. CARES Act funds were just coming out then, but we were still collecting normally. And so we watched that number, and we were satisfied that we still wanted to go ahead and acquire buildings just like we had in the past. Of course, the interest rate markets, most particularly the two GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, their spreads widened even as the 10-year was falling. back in that April to June time period. And so interest rates shot up to around 4.5%. We like to take on 15-year term loans. And so there wasn't much transacting. A lot of people were holed up and not performing due diligence, or owners weren't wanting to list their markets or list their buildings at that time due to the what was called COVID stain. But through the summer, the market started to free up again. And, of course, spreads came in quite a bit, to the point where in late summer through the fall, you could lock in a 10 to 15 year loan anywhere from 2.5% to 3%. And so when you lower your borrowing cost, if you're taking a 75 to 80% loan by 100 basis points, leave everything else in your model the same, you can pay 15% more and still achieve the same cash on cash return. And so I didn't realize that until July or so, when I got submitted a potential purchase, and I'm like, wow, we're way overpaying for this. We can't do this, even though the yield was the same to us. And so that's when the dynamic really kicked in with me that, okay, hotels and retail are really wiped out. Those investors are looking for other places to put their money. Some coastal market multifamily owners are disappointed with what their states are doing. And, you know, you had the social unrest on top of that causing problems in urban areas. And investors started to look inland, which in the past for many, many years was the vast wasteland, you know, flyover for institutional equity. And these folks started coming into our market and competing on buildings. And, you know, it's just a simple case of supply and demand, where today we're revaluing our portfolio. We do it. We used to do it twice a year. We haven't done it since December 2019. But when Andy's group completes it, I wouldn't be surprised if the valuations are up 20%, just simply because on a company-wide basis, our values were about, you know, 6.1 or 6.2 cap. And now probably at a 5. I mean, we're losing deals in places like Little Rock in the high 3s on a standard C building, nice C building. And Columbus, Ohio, Dublin, we lost a B building, just run-of-the-mill B building. You could probably value add at a 3.5. And I mean, it's madness currently.
Yeah, well, we've got about 3.5 minutes left in this segment. Andy, take us on a little bit deeper dive of what you're finding in when you're going through these valuations.
Yeah, absolutely. We always value the portfolio about twice a year. And so we had just finished the valuation right before COVID hit. And, you know, we were showing there had been some downward pressure on cap rates at that time. So it had been increasing. But, you know, when we got to the middle of the year when we would normally revalue, we just didn't really feel like it made sense. You know, we weren't sure what the next 6 months were going to hold, weren't sure where interest rates were going to land. So we held off, and we're getting ready to value portfolio now. Of course, the valuation is driven primarily by three things. Our net operating income, which, as Bob's alluded to, has been up over COVID. And the second component is the cost of, you know, our financing, which has been down dramatically a couple years ago, and even in the, you know, initially in COVID, rates were around 4 to 4.5%. Now rates are down. We've done some deals at sub 3% interest rates for long-term Fannie Mae debt. And the final piece is the cap rate, which is, you know, linked to the cost of interest, but also linked to the attractiveness of the market. And as Bob mentioned, you know, office is, you know, there's a question mark on office. Mm-hmm. How much is this work from home thing going to set a trend? Retail's been devastated, and I think everybody's looking at multifamily and realizing, you know, people always need a place to live no matter what's going on in the economy. So for that reason, cap rates are really being driven down. So when you put all those pieces together, you know, NOI is up, cost of borrowing is down, cap rates are down, we're really going to you know, it's really putting upward pressure on the on pricing for us to acquire new deals. Obviously, it's putting, you know, a lift on the value of our portfolio. But to the extent we're really buy and hold investors, that doesn't necessarily do us any good.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to know, but it doesn't increase our performance where we're having the pressure to acquire new deals at higher prices.
And, we've got about a minute and a half left. Bob, I wanted to ask you, looking into your crystal ball, where do you think once we come out of the pandemic completely, the pricing of multifamily assets is going to go?
Well, it's probably a tale of two or three cities again. You have the 10-year back up into the 160 range, and so on 10- and 15-year GSE financing, I mean, you're kind of looking at now 3.5% to 4%. So I think we've seen the bottom of where cap rates are going to be, but it's still supply and demand, and investors are still seeing that, look, you know, multifamily held up great, just like we held up great after the Great Recession of 2008 to 2010. You know, this is a place that you can achieve good returns, solid returns, and consistent returns. And, you know, they want to be there. And so just like, unfortunately, like the stock market kind of goes sometimes, and hopefully not in the way that GameStop or AMC got traded. I think people are seeing that multifamily is a place to be, and almost, you know, I don't want to envision it trading like a commodity, but it's starting to act like that. So, you know, I just think the demand is going to keep being strong for multifamily, and pricing is going to be high. Maybe not as high as it is right now, but it'll still be pretty high.
Okay. Well, we are going to break it here. We will be back after these messages with our final segment of this episode of Multifamily Matters. You're listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.
Do you have multiple multifamily properties in your portfolio? Take control of your unpredictable IT spending with our managed IT services. Whether you have 5 or 500 properties, CTS has you covered with 24/7 nationwide remote and on-site support. Our pricing allows you to budget IT costs year after year with a predictable flat monthly rate. CTS provides the expertise, management, support, and tech infrastructure for all your properties. Call 888-255-9715 or visit ctsglobaltech.com for a free quote.
In a world where keeping up with an ever-evolving technology landscape continues to be a challenge, Allegion helps property managers cut through the noise to supply their residents with the amenity most critical to the digital generation, mobile access control. Ideal for the multifamily market, Allegion has designed mobile-enabled solutions that streamlines access while providing the security and benefits for developers, property managers, and residents alike. To learn more about Allegion's access control product offerings, please visit usallegion.com/MFM. COVID-19 has greatly impacted the multifamily industry, emphasizing the need to reduce costs and increase revenue right now. PM Workforce can help you by providing intensely trained, performance-ready, certified leasing professionals. On-demand labor gives you more control over staffing costs. Their proprietary technology allows you to solve staffing problems within 60 minutes, 24/7, 365. Go to PMWorkforce.com before making a long-term hiring decision. Try one of their leasing professionals today. PM Workforce, the leasing company, consistently excellent.
Well, we are back with our final segment of this episode of Multifamily Matters, and today we're discussing something that is very important and timely to the multifamily industry. Our topic is the real effects of multifamily, the real effects on multifamily assets of COVID and the eviction moratorium. I'm Paul Marks. Joining me by phone are two longtime multifamily industry veterans, Bob Nichols, the owner and CEO of Monarch Investments and Management Group, and Andy Newell, the CFO of Monarch Investments and Management Group. Bob, you said in earlier segments of the show that during COVID, Monarch did very well. That you were on top of things by the way you talked about your approach from day one. Let's talk a little bit about some of the actual statistics. Tell us a little bit about how you guys did during COVID.
Sure. So for the 8 years leading up to 2020, in the middle of the country, we grew our gross income between 5% and 6% a year. And during 2020, it was 4.5%. And so, you know, wasn't quite up to our standards, but, you know, we were dealing with a worldwide pandemic. And so we were really happy about that. We beat our gross income budget, which, you know, we always set around 3.5% growth, and our net income budget. So when COVID hit, we went and talked to all of our suppliers, you know, for floor coverings, appliances, widgets, you name it, and said, hey, we got to have discounts. And we already had big discounts from all of them because obviously we're a big buyer with 64,000 units. And they gave it to us. And so we were able to compress our expenses a little bit. And our profit margin, which normally is 25%, operating, if you look at gross income, the gross margin is 50%, and then our debt service is 25%. So going into the pandemic, it was 25% or so profit margin, went up to 27 or 28% with expense savings and the fact we were still hitting our gross income budget. And so, you know, we still get those daily collection reports through yesterday. We collected 96% of our budgeted March gross income, which was 1.9% better than February. And February was about 75 basis points better than December, which was our best collection month ever. Now, I could have never told you those kind of stats a year ago because we didn't have a daily collection report. But we were worried like everybody else. Are we going to collect rent like normal? And so it's great to have a system like Yardi that could go back in and recreate all those numbers for analytics, you know, on a daily basis.
Yeah, well, I mean, you definitely took an analytical, you know, look at everything, which certainly, hopefully, a lot of our listeners will see this and learn from that example. Andy, I'm sure you were an important piece of that. Tell us a little bit about what you saw on your end.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, when this first started, we didn't know how it would play out. And we're primarily a cash flow investor. You know, we invest in cash flow, try to make quarterly distributions to our investors. And, you know, not knowing how things were going to play out, we decided we would start to hold back a little bit of those distributions just to make sure. You know, we didn't know how long COVID was going to last. If it was going to be 6 months, you know, we were probably fine. If it was going to be 3 years, we, you know, probably really needed to think about how things were going to continue to evolve, even though right out of the gate collections were high and we started making efforts to conserve on the expense side. We had some risk over the long term. So we started holding back a little bit to make sure we had a cushion there. As it turned out, you know, it feels like COVID, the end of COVID's right around the corner. We've been able to increase distributions to our investors by 25 basis points during COVID, even after holding back a little bit of additional cash. So, you know, again, I think that speaks to how we're really trying to make sure we attended to everything. I mean, the collection side, we worked with residents, and our site staff did a phenomenal job. On the expense side, we tried to do everything we could to get discounts or just to, you know, reduce, cut back on projects if that's what it took. And then on the cash conservation side, you know, we just let our investors know we were going to pull back a little bit on distributions. Everybody was overwhelmingly supportive. Likewise, they were overwhelmingly supportive when we told them we were going to send out $1 million in bonuses to our employees. So, you know, that's kind of what we saw on that side. You know, some other challenges we had were recruiting, you know, with the enhanced unemployment. You know, we were competing with the federal government for employees. They wanted to pay them not to work, and we wanted to pay them a fair wage to work. So we had significant recruiting challenges, but our recruiting department stuck through it, and we were able to, you know, keep our open positions pretty close to where our target was.
Yeah, I was curious to ask you guys the same question that I've asked a few of our guests on the show, and that is, when it comes to employee turnover, you know, what I heard from a lot of people is that right when COVID happened, there was not a lot of turnover when it first started, because nobody was as far as people taking the initiative to look for another opportunity, they didn't think they would be able to find it. But then once things started to get a little bit better, they kind of went back to the normal percentages. Are you seeing the same thing?
Yeah, we have seen a recent uptick. Oh, go ahead, Bob.
Oh, go ahead, Andy. You've got it.
Yeah, we have seen a recent uptick in that. And I mean, I think there is some frustration by people just from COVID. I mean, I don't even think it's our operating environment. We do surveys of our employees when they leave, and generally they're very favorable. But I think, you know, people have had family changes, and I think some people have put off looking for a job for that reason during COVID. And I think that there are a lot of natural reasons why, you know, there is turnover. And I think some of those reasons are starting to manifest itself. So we have seen an uptick in that.
Okay. And I know you mentioned it before, Bob, but let's talk about occupancy. What are you seeing as far as occupancy goes throughout your portfolio?
Well, we went into COVID at 95.5%, and we're averaging over 97% now. Of course, towards the end of the month, it gets up to 97.2 or so, and then folks move out, and it drops to 96.8 or something, and then floats up again. So, you know, we worked hard on the protocols that we were talking about earlier so that we could stay open. And we had a lot of residents who drove up to our offices with vans and trailers and said, hey, we're supposed to move in down the street. Their office isn't open. Do you have any units we can move into? And so, you know, we picked up their renewal rates. Always were kind of in the low 60s heading into COVID, and they jumped up to 70% with people less apt to want to move today. And so we made up for a little bit of collection losses, and I think we went into COVID with like 1.2% or so of collection losses, and it went up to 2% or just over 2%. We made up for that by being a little fuller and having a little less turnover with those days vacant and the cost to turn a unit.
One last question I want to ask before we transition to something else, Bob. As part of reinventing the wheel, I guess, when you had to put everything into place, how did you embrace any new technologies that were out there that maybe you hadn't thought of before? Was that something that you considered or actually did?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Whether it was in the field or in the office, you know, Andy's group, as he was mentioning, for about 2 months, we had most of the corporate people working from home. So, you know, that was utilizing laptops and Zoom calls and all that. And then the different ways to keep safe in the offices. And then for the maintenance staff, you know, buying electrostatic sprayers to go and sanitize an area before you know, performing a work order. So we looked everywhere, and if there was something that was going to help us operate, we bought it.
Great, great. And is virtual touring something that you were doing prior to the pandemic or since?
You know, not really, but we did that too. And you know, quite frankly, most of our leasing staff were comfortable showing units. Now, we did it in a different way. We might have had the model open and, you know, someone would come to the door and they'd, you know, keep 10 feet apart and they'd, you know, walk together in the outdoors where the virus doesn't transmit very well. And our staff would, you know, let the potential resident look at the unit on their own, and then they'd come out and discuss things going back to the office. So we changed a lot of the things we did, but virtual touring certainly was a piece of that puzzle.
Okay, great. Well, I want to transition. I want to ask you guys a little bit about, tell us about, I always ask our guests in the last part of the last segment, tell us how you got into the industry and a little bit about the company and what you guys are looking for right now. We've got about 2.5 minutes left. I'll start with you, Andy.
Yeah, when I've been with Monarch about 9.5 years, and when I first interviewed with, you know, Bob, I wasn't really sure about the position. And after meeting with him and seeing his commitment to doing business right, taking care of his investors, and taking care of his employees, you know, I was sort of blown away. You know, Bob mentioned that, you know, we've allocated over $85 million in equity to employees, and that doesn't include all the other great things that, that Bob does for people. So that was really, you know, what hooked me on Monarch, and, you know, it's held up ever since.
Fantastic. Bob, tell us a little bit about how you got started.
Well, as Andy says, I'm a fully recovered CPA. I got out of school in 1980 and did some auditing, and then I worked as a workout guy for a savings loan during the late 80s, and then started Monarch in 1990, or started First Pacific, the forerunner to Monarch, in 1992 with a gentleman who's about 16, 17 years older than me, and then he retired around 2001, and I carried on as Monarch. But we're a private company, which is great because our information can always be public to our investors, as opposed to a public company that's, you know, required only to give out information at one time, 10-Ks, 10-Qs, and so forth. And so so we can be open, transparent with our investors as much as we like, and that's really refreshing.
Yeah, that is. Tell us a little bit about, just briefly, we've talked a little bit in the first segment about Monarch, your size, and where you're located, and so forth.
Sure. We're in Franktown, Colorado. That's about 30 miles south-southeast of Denver, in between the springs. And we do have 64,000 units and about 250 projects. Again, our investor base is all private. We're not a REIT, and we don't accept any institutional funds. And so, and we're in 21 states in the middle of the country. And as Andy mentioned, we're big net buyers and long-term holders that look for good cash flow out of properties and certainly appreciation of the buildings as well.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to have you both on the show. I'm excited to see the ranking in the National Multifamily Housing Council's report of the largest owners, to see you guys move up a few spots this year when it comes out in April. We'd love to have you back again on the show. It's been very informative. You had an inspirational way of dealing with these issues with the pandemic and the moratorium. And eviction moratorium, and I think that a lot of people can learn from that. But we will be back next week with another power panel of industry experts and a great topic. You are listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.
Thank you for listening to Multifamily Matters, a weekly radio show that discusses current topics and trends in the multifamily industry. To find out more about the show or make suggestions for topics or interesting guests, go to multifamilyradio.com. You have been listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.